Throughout the history of terrorism, the press has been in a bind. To fully inform the public about terrorist attacks and how they happen without supplying the very notoriety the killers crave. Writing in Pointer this week, Indira Lakshmanan argues that whatever the responsible balance is, it's not the one that was struck in the coverage of the bombing at the Manchester Arena. Indira, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
What did you see that you objected to?
What I object to is the endless repeated hours upon hours of the same footage being shown of handheld witness cell phone video and analysts talking over it and anchors describing it again and again.
What we've consistently heard from witnesses on the ground, at least one loud noise, a bang, a blast of some kind, and then that has triggered the fear and the frenzy that followed.
One thing we can say, this statement did say in Arabic that this was one of ISIS's soldiers that had attacked what they described as crusaders.
Was this attack acting by himself or was he part of a larger network? And frankly, at the moment, the police do not know, which is why they have raised the terror level to critical.
We saw it in the Manchester bombing. We saw it in the Boston bombing, in Orlando, San Bernardino.
Okay, Pierre, I want to go again to the video of the explosion. We're going to slow it down. Look again at this video.
The worst mass shooting in American history, worst terror attack here in the United States since 9/11. Lauren Lister has been on the scene all morning long in Orlando, Florida.
A massive manhunt for the armed gunman in California came to a head. But this was the scene moments earlier. Captured on camera by neighbors.
Oh,
and what lodged in my mind was this image of this poor young girl jumping off of a staircase in her terror to get away from this terrible bombing. Study after study has shown that by repeating these kinds of images, we're not only traumatizing the victims who've lived through this attack and the relatives of those who'd perished, but we're traumatizing people watching from across the world. Other people become anesthetized and numb. They see repeated images of terrorism and it just sort of washes over them. It doesn't mean anything to them anymore. But both of these extremes do happen to people, and it's been documented.
I might add a third, that it's carrying the water for terrorist organizations in their recruitment of people to perpetrate precisely this kind of act, right?
Absolutely, Bob. We know that Daesh, or ISIS, as we call it in the U.S., they know that they're going to get notoriety, even posthumously. And they know that youth who are suffering from alienation or anomy, who are vulnerable to being recruited by ISIS, react positively to this. And it's not something that's unique to terrorism. We know from the diaries and the social media accounts of people who've participated in school shootings that they too sought to be on television and imagined how they would always be remembered for what they did.
One of your gripes is that the amount of space and time devoted to terror attacks makes the risk to the general public seem far greater than it is, not to mention usurping coverage of other things that actually do have a much greater effect on us all. What's the data behind that allegation?
First of all, if the issue is that we're concerned about death toll, the if it bleeds, it leads, we should be covering when the most bodies pile up, then all Americans would know a heck of a lot more about the recent mudslides in Colombia that killed more than 200 people, or the 1,683 Americans who die on average every day from heart disease. There was an incredibly interesting study done by Namil Dalal in Priceonomics in 2015 that showed that terrorism deaths are the single most heavily covered type of death per capita in the first pages of the New York Times compared to every other way that a human can die. A scholar at the University of Western Australia, behavioral economist, looked at 60,000 terrorist attacks covered in the New York Times over a period between 1970 and 2012 and found that with each additional story from the New York Times about a terrorist attack, the chances of having an additional follow-up attack went up by between 11% and 15%, and the chance of additional casualties went up by 1 to 2 deaths within the week afterwards. Now, I'm not pointing the finger at the New York Times, certainly not. I'm just saying that even in such a good publication that's so influential, it is out of proportion partly because it's human nature.
Look, you're not the first to make these observations, because it's so clear that wall-to-wall coverage, especially on cable TV, goes far beyond the basics of delivering the news and mutates into something else altogether, and I'm not sure quite what. You have suggestions for what the press can do instead, and I wonder if you'd list a few of them.
Rather than referring to terrorists as claiming responsibility or claiming credit, I would argue we should be saying they're admitting guilt, because it's murder. They're not responsible for anything. They don't deserve credit for anything. So I would say deprive the terrorists of what they want, which is the spotlight and the glory and the ability to recruit. You can also show the effects of terrorism in a deeply emotional way that will really touch the hearts of your audience in ways that don't emphasize the gore and the blood. And one example that I give is that you can include photographs that show the victim's personal effects that were left behind, shoes, stuffed animals, or flowers placed to commemorate the victims rather than body parts. To give you one example of positive coverage, Sky News, a UK television outlet, specifically took the video from the Manchester police, who in the hours after the attack announced that they would have a zero tolerance policy for hate crimes.
More than ever, it is vital that our diverse communities that make Greater Manchester such a strong place actually stand together and support each other.
Sky News took a video of this and tweeted it out, shared it on all their social channels. So that was a way for them to put out the message that, hey, you know, let's not let this be an excuse for retaliatory hate crimes against Muslims in the community, for example.
Okay, so here's how life is on the ground. A terrorist episode happens. Immediately thereafter comes chaos. Sometimes television crews don't get to the scene for quite a while. All we have to rely on is cell phone footage and images taken by victims and bystanders. And it very quickly becomes iconic because it's all we have to look at for a while after the incident. And therefore, there is this impulse, I think, for the cable news and for broadcast TV to go back to those images in subsequent reports, because they're shortcuts. They contextualize whatever the new developments are that they're discussing next. Now, yes, they may be traumatic, and yes, they may be anesthetizing, but they're also really handy for guiding the audience into the story. Is it always wrong?
I'm talking about proper balance here. It's not always or never. Of course, certain footage becomes iconic. Of course, anybody who's old enough to have lived through 9/11 remembers iconic footage of the towers burning and of people jumping out of those towers to their death. But not everything is an icon. A photo of a young girl in Vietnam fleeing napalm, that's an iconic image. But the same image of a girl jumping off a staircase in an endless loop in Manchester, that's not an iconic image. So not everything is of the same value just because it's taken in a moment of news. And that's why not every image wins a Pulitzer Prize or an Emmy.
Indira, thank you very much.
A pleasure to talk to you, Bob.
Indira Lakshmanan is, among other things, a columnist for the Boston Globe and a guest host for WAMU and NPR's 1A.
Coming up, how to rid the web of ISIS recruitment videos. As the saying goes, there's an app for that.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.